Okay. Welcome, everybody. This is Lecture 6 of the Mises Academy's Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology Through Price Theory. I was just mentioning to the people who are here early that we are just about ready to send out an announcement for when the second round of this course comes up, where we're going to cover chapters 5 through 9 of Man, Economy, and States. That's basically all of production theory, and then entrepreneurship is what we'll be doing in the next class. So it's basically the market process. Okay, so we're sort of giving you the basics in this opening course, and then the next one is where you're really going to understand this is how a market economy works in the Austrian vision. Okay, so anyway, but again, we'll send out the official thing once it's set in stone, but that's for sure it's going to be chapters 5 through 9, but I don't want to say any dates officially yet, just to make sure we're not conflicting with anything. Okay, so for tonight's lecture, we've got a lot of material to cover. So let's spend some time here talking about the balance of payments. Now here, this Rothbard, I just want you to understand rhetorically what Rothbard's doing here. It's pretty interesting, even though he doesn't beat you over the head with this. Normally, when you start talking about the balance of payments, it's in the context of international trade, where you're worried about, do we have a trade deficit with some other country or with the world? And what's going to happen? Are we losing jobs? Are we losing, we've got to run out of money, that kind of stuff. And so normally what happens is people are introduced to the concept of a balance of payments and possible deficits or surpluses in the balance of payments in the context of international trade, where that's a loaded term. I mean, just the very term trade deficit, that sounds bad, right? Oh, you don't want a deficit. And I guess unless you're talking about, I'm ordering my lunch today, I want to have a poison deficit in it. Okay, but normally the very term deficit sounds like it's bad. And so what happens is people are always on defense. Defenders of the free market are always trying to say, oh, no, we don't need to have a tariff. We don't need to have restrictions on how people spend their money internationally, that sort of thing. Even if there is a trade deficit or a negative balance of payments or whatever term they want to use. And then as an analogy, oftentimes the free market person will say, well, look, I mean, let's take this concept of a balance of payments and apply it on an individual level. And then we would see, how silly it is to wring our hands over the balance of payments or the trade deficit when it comes to a national scale. Because to talk about the balance of payments for an entire nation is, that all you're really doing is summing up the balance of payments for all the people in the nation. And that's how you come up with that figure. There's nothing qualitatively different. It's just you're summing it all up. And so if we can see that on an individual household level, this concept of a balance of payments doesn't lead to catastrophe, well then, if you add up 150 million households, you should get the same result. Okay? So what I'm pointing out here is what Rothbard does is interesting. He introduces the concept of a balance of payments at the individual level. Okay, so he's in a sense diffusing that term from the outset. Because in Man, Economy, and States so far, we haven't gotten international trade. We're still talking about guys trading barrels of fish for horses, and we're just now getting into price theory. So when Rothbard's here talking about balance of payments, he's introducing it in the context of a household or an individual. And so then if that's how you learn the concept, you're going to be forever inoculated against the fallacious uses to which protectionists put the concept. Okay, so anyway, I like the way he did that, and I think he did that consciously, but I don't know my point is being that in another textbook, for example, if you're taking introduction to microeconomics at the college level and you're doing consumer theory, they're probably not going to go over something called the balance of payments and look at changes in the cash balance at the household level, right? Because balance of payments normally in economics refers to international trade. So anyway, I just think that's an interesting thing he did, and I just want to give you the context as to why maybe he did it that way. But be that as it may, whatever the reason, let's just go over what the balance of payments statement is saying. Okay, so this top equation says that, hang on, let me get my pointer. So this top one says that money income equals money expenditures plus net additions to cash balances. Okay, so it's important here, whenever in economics you see an equation, you have to be really careful and don't attribute causality to it. Okay, so this is an accounting truism. After, you know, for any given period that we're looking at, this equation is going to be true, but you can't start saying, well, what if I change one of the elements in the equation and then you think you know that it's going to change something else. Okay, so for example, just looking at this thing, money income equals money expenditures plus net addition to the cash balances. You can't just say, oh, well, if I just put $20 more in my cash balances, that makes the right-hand side of the equation go up, therefore my income just went up by $20. Well, no, you can't just magically make your income go up just by putting money into your cash balances. Normally, the way we think of it is for a given person, your income is what it is, and then you divide it up between your expenditures and your additions to cash balances. So if you want to put more money in your cash balance, that leaves less left over for you to go spend during that time period for a given income. Okay, so we're going to see this again and again, especially if you stick around till the third course when we're going over Rothbard's critique of Keynesian economics. There it's beautiful. You know, the Keynesians have an equation y equals c plus I plus g plus net exports. And you see lots of Keynesian, especially on the blogosphere, a lot of people saying, well, look at, there's the equation. It's a tautology, you know, it's an accounting truism, so you can't argue with it. So obviously, during a recession, if we want to boost output, we just need to raise government spending. Because look at, we see right there, the equation says the government, or total output equals consumption spending plus investment spending plus government spending plus net exports. So we raise G, that's going to raise output. And no, that doesn't follow. The equation has to be true, but if something on the right-hand side goes up, it doesn't mean the left-hand side has to go up. It could mean something else on the right-hand side goes down. Just like here, this top equation, if I tell you that my money income is, in a certain month, is $10,000, and that my money expenditures are $9,000, and my net addition to cash balances are $1,000, okay, the equation's true. And now what if I say, oh, but suppose my net addition to cash balances is $2,000. So does that mean my money income must have gone up to $11,000? Well, no. It means your money expenditures must have gone down. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, so it's pretty obvious, but let me just make sure you're not missing anything here. So why is this equation true? Because we just think of it. So money income is what it suggests. It's how much money is coming in the door. And so then what can you do with it? You can either spend it or you add it to your cash balance. Those are the only two possibilities. So that's why the equation is true here. Now be careful, this money expenditures, that means expenditures on anything. So whether you go out and buy a pizza, or whether you go out and buy a piece of land, or whether you go out and buy a bond, those are all money expenditures for the purposes of this equation. Okay, so here we're not classifying spending. In other words, in common parlance, a lot of times people might say, oh, what'd you do with that money? Did you spend it or did you invest it or did you save it? And they don't necessarily mean that you literally put it in a piggy bank or like put it under your mattress. So if you took it and bought a bond with it, a lot of people would say that, oh, you didn't spend it, you saved it. Okay, so we're going to go over those concepts carefully later on. I'm just pointing out here, don't be confused. When we say money expenditures, we mean anything for which you exchange your units of money. And so whether you're trading them for a box of pizza or whether you're trading them for somebody's bond or a share of corporate stock or a piece of real estate, that is expending your money. Okay, so once you realize that, then you can see how obvious this equation is. Okay, so that's why money income has to be equal to money expenditures plus net additions to the cash balance. Now, one thing to keep in mind here is this is two things. First of all, you'll notice I collapsed this equation. The way Rothbard writes it in Man, Economy, and State, he says, I think it's something like money income equals money expenditures plus net additions to cash balances minus net subtractions from cash balance, something like that, which to me is redundant. That's what the word net there is doing. Now, if you go and read the context, the reason Rothbard's doing that is because he's handling certain transactions one way and then saying on net that's an addition, and then he's handling certain transactions a different way and saying on net that's a subtraction, and then he's putting the two terms together. But what I've written here is still correct. Okay, that it's the net additions means of all the changes in your cash balances over this time period, just look at, you know, have the things cancel out. So if sometimes your cash balances went up, other times it went down, we just want to look at the net change over the whole period. Okay, so that's another thing worth emphasizing. This equation is a flow equation. Okay, this is true over a certain period of time. Okay, so it doesn't make sense to say apply this equation at 3:40 p.m. yesterday. That doesn't make any sense. It makes sense to say, oh, apply this equation over the last month or over the last quarter or over the last year. Then you can apply the equation because it's a flow equation. It's sort of like saying, how many gallons of water went past a certain point in a river. You know, you could talk about the flow. You could say, oh, 100,000 gallons went by in the last 2 hours. Or you could say, you know, 2 million gallons went by in the last 3 weeks or something. But it wouldn't make sense to say this second how many gallons are going by, because you'd give a rate, and even then there'd be time built into it. Okay. Whereas it does make sense to say right now, what's the level of the river? You know, like how deep is it? Or how high is it? Is it near flood stage? Okay, that would be a stock concept, okay? Just like you could talk about your cash balance at any given time, because that's just a number. That's called a stock variable. Okay, but here we're talking about changes to your cash balance. All right, so let me just make sure you get that. I'm hoping for most of you this is very easy stuff, and I'm just belaboring the obvious, but I want to make sure nobody's getting lost here. So this is, I see someone asking, this is Lecture 6, Derek. People are asking in the comments section. Okay, so this equation is just talking about changes in the cash balance. So if you started out with nothing in your cash balance and your money income is $10,000 and you only spent $9,000 over the course of a month, well then at the end of the month you would have $1,000 in your cash balance, okay, because it went from zero at the beginning of the period to $1,000 at the end of the period, so the net additions were $1,000, and so that's where that's coming from. But now let's go to the next month. So now going into month number two, you start out with $1,000 in your cash balance. And so if you did the same thing again, your money income for month two was $10,000 and your expenditures for month two were only $9,000, well then again, the net additions to your cash balance would only be $1,000. But since your cash balance, the stock level of it started at $1,000, now you're adding an additional $1,000, so you end month two having $2,000. Okay, and let's just do one more. Now for month three. So for all these things, remember, you had to specify a time period. So here I'm using the unit of analysis as 1 month. Now going into month three, your money income is $10,000, but up you got in a car accident. Well, that's too expensive. You got a toothache, and so you went to the dentist, and you had really high medical bills this month. So your money expenditures in month three were $10,500. Okay, remember, normally you would spend $9,000, but this month, you had that $1,500 bill from the dentist, and so you spent $10,500. So now what happens? Your money income was $10,000. Your money expenditures were $10,500. So what were the net additions to your cash balance? Negative $500. Okay, so that's how that works. The net, to make this equation work, the net additions sometimes is negative if you spent more than your income. All right? And so there, at the end of month three, you have, $1,500 in your cash balance. Because at the start of month three, you had $2,000 in your cash balance. And then over the course of month three, the net additions to your cash balance was negative $500. And so that's why by the end of month three, your cash, the stock of your cash balance is now is $1,500. Because over the course of month three, you drew down your cash balances by $500. All right, so that's how that works, that your cash balance is itself a stock variable that you can talk about it at a given moment in time. Boom, what's the cash balance right now? But income and expenditures are flow variables that you can only talk about over a certain duration of time. And so over a certain period of time, the difference between your income flow and your expenditure flow changes the level of your cash balances. Okay, so I'm hoping this is shedding light on this for some of you. Okay. And I say, or, and at the bottom, and here we clearly see Rothbard making the analogy to international trade. He says, another way of describing all this is to say that exports equal imports plus net additions to the cash balance. Because what does it mean to talk about money income? Well, you earn income when you sell goods and services. And also, Rothbard shows that, you know, gifts, technically, we've got to worry about that. That has to get in there somehow, too. Okay. So exports are when you sell goods and services, and that can include your labor services, and people pay you for it. That's how you earn income. And then what are money expenditures? Well, that's when you have money flowing out the door in exchange for goods and services that you're buying. Okay, so you're acquiring real goods and services when you spend money. And so that's why those are imports. It's, you're bringing in stuff that was produced outside of your household when you go and buy stuff. Okay, so that's why this term export and import. So again, you can use these terms to refer to a given individual or a household. It sounds a little bit funny, but Rothbard's point here is he wants you to start thinking of it at the individual level, where it's easy to picture and you're not going to be led astray. And then once you get it down pat for there, you can go ahead and expand it to the case of an entire country, and you're much less likely to make a mistake in your reasoning. Okay, so let's move on here. Okay, this slide, making money, I don't know if you can tell in the picture here, but that guy's holding a big chunk of gold, or at least he hopes it's gold. So what we're doing is we're showing, I'm emphasizing that we're still talking about a free market in this part of the book. All right, basically all of man, economy, and state, except for, I guess chapter 12, where he gets into the violent intervention in the market. All right, but I think up until that point, the assumption is we are in a free market economy where there's property rights that are respected, and we're just following out the economic analysis from those assumptions. So when we talk about money, first of all, Rothbard thinks it's a commodity. It doesn't have to be gold, but in a modern economy, it probably would be gold. So it's something that was in the marketplace, a commodity for its own, you know, on its own merits, if you will, and then it became a medium of exchange. And that's where money comes from, right? So there are people who produce money. And so I just want you to make sure you understand is, let's go back one slide. So here, this top part, money income equals money expenditures plus net additions to the cash balance, you can apply that formula even to somebody who is a gold miner, right? So somebody, you know, let's say you're a company, a small company that you own 100% of, and you own a gold mine. What's your business? You hire workers, maybe. You know, you buy resources, and you pay people to come in and dynamite holes in the rock going into your mine. You pay other people to come and they lay down track. You pay workers to show up and they get into the, you know, on the carts and they go down in the mines, and you buy pickaxes and stuff for them and they go in there. I mean, I actually don't know how modern mining works. I'm probably confusing it with coal mining from 100 years ago, but you get the idea. You're running a business. But the one thing that makes your business different from every other business in a market economy is every other business, they sell the final product to a customer who then pays them with gold. If we're talking about a society where the gold is, where money is gold. Okay? So that's, you know, if you're growing apples, you do the same thing. You pay workers, you buy fertilizer, you do all this stuff, and you harvest the apples and you sell them to somebody, and that person pays you in gold coins, let's say, or bars of gold if you're selling a lot of apples. But when it comes to the gold producers, obviously they're not going to sell the gold to somebody for gold. They get their revenues from the mining itself. It's its own yield, as it were. All right, so, but they still do profit and loss statements, and they have accountants and whatever who can look at their costs and revenues. It's just their revenue comes from the ground, right? That they have to decide, if we spent whatever, you know, 100 gold ounces to revolutionize our extraction equipment, to buy, you know, the latest machinery, to bring in workers from around the country who are really skilled, you know, dynamite here, do this and this, you know, that's going to cost money to do all that stuff. Maybe it'll cost 100 gold ounces, and then what's going to be my return on that investment? And then, you know, they have their geologists and other people make estimates and say, oh, if you did that, well, then we think, you know, you'd be able to extract such and such more gold ounces per month than if you didn't spend that extra money. And so then the question is that extra flow, the extra income of gold ounces per month, does that justify spending that investment up front? Okay, so it's identical in terms of the bookkeeping and everything to any other firm. Just the one crucial difference is the product is, you know, when all is said and done, they are producing gold itself. So they don't have to sell the product to somebody for money, because they are literally producing the money in the market economy. And then, of course, that's where everybody else is getting their money that they then spend in turn. Okay, so it's kind of neat to just think through the implications of that. In our day and age with fiat money, it's hard, you know, I myself have a hard time getting out of the mentality of thinking the money comes from the government. And, you know, money is green pieces of paper in my case, because I use U.S. dollars, that the Fed or the Treasury, whatever, creates, And that's what where the money comes from. And then we all are making goods and services trying to get these green pieces of paper. But in a pure market economy, the money itself would come into existence from firms who specialize in producing money. And so some firms would specialize in digging up, you know, raw gold, if you will, unprocessed gold from the ground, and then they would sell it maybe to mints, right? So there would be other firms, and their specialty, they wouldn't be mining the gold. Their specialty is they would buy wholesale gold, if you will, and take it and then smash it up and melt it down and then hammer it into really intricate, beautiful gold coins that, you know, were stamped a certain way and, you know, the edges were what do you call that, ridged, I forget the term, so that you couldn't shave off the, you know, the edges and so forth and clip the coins. And they would do that, okay? And so there, you know, there would be a whole industry of producing money in gold coins or silver or whatever the heck the money commodity was in the market. Okay, so that's, but my point is here, in terms of the accounting and stuff, those firms would still have record keeping and bookkeeping. It's just the one difference would be that the people who are actually mining the gold, you know, again, they wouldn't have any customers. That's where they would get their gold revenue from, would be the ground. Okay, this slide saying time frame matters. So here, the reason I'm going over this is I really want to make sure you guys understand how cash balances work in the real world. That, because if you think it through this, even though it's simple, it'll give you a better idea of, it'll help you avoid some fallacies when later on we start talking about hoarding, stuff like that. All right, so Robert says, if you're looking at somebody's, and I'm sorry, I gotta keep bouncing around here, but this equation, this top equation, it's gonna look different depending on the scale of the time frame. Okay, so he says, you know, over the course of a typical month, the change to the cash balance might not move that much. He said, but if you're looking at it on a daily basis, well, then things are going to look a lot different. Because let's say it's a worker, a typical worker who gets paid twice a month. Rothbard said, like, let's say on the 15th and the 30th of the month, Rothbard says, if you construct this equation and the time frame you have in mind is that particular day, well, then the money income that day is going to be huge, right? Because the person is going to get a paycheck for 2 weeks of work. And so, the strictly speaking, you know, if you interpret this equation at face value, that money income on that particular day, the 15th of the month, is going to be huge. It's going to be a lot more than the person goes and spends at the store and spends buying gas for his car and whatever on that particular day. So what's going to happen is most of that paycheck is going to just go into his cash balances. So if you look at this guy's bank account on the 15th, the balance is going to go way up. All right, and then on the 16th, he's going to draw it down some. And on the 17th, he's going to draw it down some. You know, he's paying bills, paying his rent check, paying his gas bill, so forth. He's going to the store. So his cash balances then dwindle, and they get drawn down. Oh, and then on the 30th, boom, they spike up again. And then they get drawn down going to the next month. And then on the 15th, they spike up again. Okay, so that's what you would see if you look at this equation day by day. But if you looked at it month by month, you wouldn't see those major swings in the cash balance where it jumps way up on the 15th and the 30th, and then it comes down gradually on every other day of the month. If you just looked at it month to month, you wouldn't see much fluctuation at all in the cash balance unless, you know, something was happening, like the person was saving up to go to a vacation in Brazil or something, and he wanted to have a lot of cash. Well, then maybe he'd start saving up for that, or he's going to go to the casino or whatever. Or on the other hand, if he's got a bunch of unexpected bills, or maybe he loses his job or something, and then he has to start living off of his savings, and so maybe he starts drawing down his cash balances. Okay, then you would even see that would show up even month to month if there was some sort of life-changing event like that. Okay, but the point is, you know, you should definitely get what I'm saying right now. So I'm hoping most of you are like, yeah, this is obvious, let's go on the next point. But if what I'm saying is a little bit unclear to you, then you should go reread that part in Rothbard to make sure you get that, because you're going to be lost when we're talking about the market for money and what happens with purchasing power and all that stuff if you're not getting this. You need to understand, why is it that people have cash balances in the first place? What's the point of even holding money? It's because you're going to spend it in the future. Okay, so holding money allows you to sort of break up the timing of your sales and your purchases. That's one way of thinking about what the function of money is. So you can go ahead and sell your labor to someone and then get paid for it, even though you're not sure what you're going to spend that money on. Okay, whereas if you couldn't use money, then you know, you'd have to go sell your labor and then get whatever you were going to get in exchange for it immediately. And so we pointed out that was one of the problems with direct exchange. So indirect exchange allows you to break up transactions into two components. You know, instead of you finding somebody that you're directly trading things for and you both walk away happier, with indirect exchange, it's, you know, one way of thinking about it is that, no, you're selling the stuff you want to sell, and then you're postponing your decision to purchase until later. Now, strictly speaking, that's not quite what's going on. Really what you're doing is you're selling what you want to sell and you're buying money. Okay, but you get the sense in which that is a little bit misleading, that really the only reason you're buying the money is because then you're going to, in turn, sell the money later for the stuff that you ultimately want. Okay. So once you understand that, you can see that's why people hold cash balances, and later on when we're talking about what's called hoarding, because people sometimes worry that, oh, a recession's caused because people are hoarding too much money, that their demand to hold cash has gone up. And we can see there's nothing insidious about people wanting to hold money. People are always holding money. The question is just sometimes they want to hold more than they do in normal times. So why is that? Okay, the last thing on this before we move on is Rothbard just points out, and again making the point with regard to international trade, that at the individual household level, it's obvious that every transaction that's going to affect your cash holdings, it's voluntary. Okay, so it would be silly to look at an individual household and say, you know, uh-oh, he's got an unfavorable balance of trade, that his, you know, he keeps spending more than his expenditures are higher than his income, and so he's got an unfavorable trade balance, and you know, this is causing irreparable damage to his cash balances. I mean, that is true in the sense that you can't just keep running a trade deficit. If you're a household, you're eventually going to run out of money. But the point is that's people know that. I mean, they're making voluntary decisions. Okay, so you can't sever the two decisions, what I'm getting at. All right, so it's not that people decide on their expenditures and their income and the cash balance just sort of passively adjust to that. I mean, it's all one and the same thing. That's what Rothbard's getting at. So he said the same thing in terms of international trade, that if the nation collectively is importing more from the rest of the world than it's exporting, I mean, each of those decisions that was involved in that was a voluntary choice. So the people decided, I want to use some of my money to send to Japan to import an automobile. And that was a voluntary transaction. And so it'd be silly to say, well, that's okay, but in the aggregate, we're in trouble because now we got more money flowing out of the country than flowing in. Right? That's kind of silly. Right? That's Rothbard's point. That, yeah, if you're worried about your dwindling cash balance as a household, what do? You start saying, uh-oh, my savings are running low, so I better stop spending so much, or I better go earn more income. And then there you go. One thing, I don't have a slide for this. I just want to mention, so if you're just, you know, if you're not an expert on this stuff, or if you're not like a really serious student, everything I've said is fine so far, and you can just file it away and we'll move on. But let me just mention one little technical point for those of you who are, you know, really advanced students, or you're going on into getting a master's or PhD or whatever. Here, the last few minutes, I've been sort of interchangeably using the phrase trade balance and trade deficit, and those are different terms. Okay, so again, if you're just taking this course to like have the view from 30,000 feet, this is an anal distinction you don't need to worry about. But I do want to make sure I'm not misleading anybody. I'm going to have an article tomorrow, so Thursday. What's that going to be? Is it June 2nd tomorrow? Get my days mixed up. Yeah, so Thursday, June 2nd, I'm going to have a Mises.org article coming out talking about international trade and quoting stuff from Mises. So I make some of these points in a footnote there if you're curious, if you want to see it spelled out more. But just for our purposes right now in this lecture, let me just point out here, let me go back. This equation, this money income equals money expenditures, that income there, that to make this equation true, that income means from any sources. So even if you are selling off assets, then that's going to count as income. Whereas in other contexts, you might not want to count that. You might want to count that as something else. You might say, well, no, income is like my earnings, you know, from selling my labor or something. But I wouldn't, if I was hard up for money and I had to sell my car for $5,000, I might not want to call that income, because there I'm just, you know, trading one asset for another. That's not really like, so, but here, to make this equation true, money income means just for any source whatsoever, if money is flowing into the household, that counts as income. So in particular here, even if you borrowed money from somebody, that would count as money income. Okay, so just think about how that works. So it's possible, if you start a month out, let's say, you know, go back to that thing where you start month three, and you start with $2,000 in your cash balances. So you've got $2,000 literally in cash sitting, you know, in your, under your bed. That's where you hide your money. You've literally got $2,000 in green pieces of paper there. And then you're starting month three, and the income from your job, your paycheck, is $10,000. But you, because of your dental bill, your expenditures are going to be $10,500. You actually don't have to pay the dentist by pulling the $500 from your cash. You could, say, call up your mom and dad and say, you know what, guys, I had this big dental bill. Can I borrow $500 from you to pay the dentist so that I don't have to dip into my savings? And they might say, okay. And so your mom and dad lend you $500. So in terms of this equation, what happened? Well, now you don't have to dip into your savings, into your cash balances. All right. So here, your money income now would be $10,500, because you get the $10,000 from your job. Your mom and dad gave you a $500 loan, so your money income would be $10,500, and then your money expenditures are $10,500, so the net addition to your cash balance is zero. So you started out with $2,000 in cash under your bed, and you ended with $2,000 in cash under your bed. Okay. Now, start of month four now, you've still got the $2,000 in cash, but you also owe your parents $500, okay, so you have that debt. Okay, but debt is not money. That's the point here. So this equation is looking strictly at money flows. It's not looking at, you know, what accountants might in other contexts consider to be like income from sale of services or something, or earnings. Okay, so I just want to make that clear. So then in the context of international trade, these terms are slightly different. So like with the trade deficit, that's not really the same thing as a negative balance of payments, because a trade deficit means foreigners are you're buying more goods from foreigners than they're buying of your goods and services. But the difference doesn't mean that literally money is flowing out of the country, because maybe the foreigners are acquiring, you know, maybe they're lending you money, maybe they're buying more of your debt. Okay, so it's not that your actual, the gold is flowing out of the country, if everyone's on a gold standard. It could just be that you're buying more of their cars and they're buying of your cars, and the difference is made up by the fact that they're buying bonds from you as well. So the amount of actual money in your country stays put, which is like the analog of a change in the cash balance. Okay, so again, if I lost some of you, don't worry, that's kind of a technical point, but I didn't want to just breeze right through that without mentioning that distinction. Okay, moving on here now, stages of production. This is where we really start to get into the Austrian approach to capital and production. So don't let this slide is what I'm getting at. All right, if you really want to understand the Austrian approach, make sure you understand this diagram, because not in this course, but if you stick around for course number 2, where we go through chapters 5 through 9, Rothbard's going to he's going to up the ante on this one. So this is just the beginning, and then he's going to take this and keep tweaking it and making it more and more complicated, but he's going to be able to show you so much more stuff. Okay, and so I promise it's worth the effort to learn it, because when all is said and done, you're going to see, like, oh my gosh, that's why Paul Krugman doesn't know what he's talking about. Okay, I mean, really, I'm not overselling it there, this is the way to understand Austrian business cycle theory and to understand why the Keynesian approach is just missing the boat. And they don't even get what the problem is with low interest rates, because they do not have a capital theory that even is as complicated as this diagram is. Okay, so I'm just urging you, whether you guys are watching right now or whether you're hearing this lecture later, that this idea of stages of production and to see this diagram that Rothbard has here early on and understand how production moves through the stages and how resources flow, that's going to be critical for later on understanding economic growth, savings and investment, and then what goes wrong in the boom-bust cycle when interest rates are manipulated by the Federal Reserve or the central bank. Okay, so at this stage, though, it's still pretty simple. What Rothbard's doing, so down here is the consumer. So this is first order goods, because remember, in the Austrian framework, the lowest order or first order goods are the consumer goods, or I guess the consumer goods right there. And then as you move up, those are higher order goods, because remember, value is grounded in subjective preferences. And so the way the Austrians envision the whole production process is at the bottom of this chain, the base upon which everything else rests, are the final consumers buying consumer goods and services. And that's where, you know, the value of those things is determined by, you know, the stocks in existence, but interacting with the subjective preferences of the consumers. That's where the market prices for those goods come from. And then to price the factors of production that go into them, you use those consumer prices. And then you start just working your way up through the chain. Okay, so how does this work? Rothbard is, so this is a sort of a complicated point here. Let me just say this, and we'll come back to this again and again. But in terms of the logical explanation for how is value determined, the Austrians say it starts down here at the consumer good, where we already know how consumer prices are formed. You know, we went through that example with the horses and the fish that I can explain to you. You know, I got a bunch of consumers who want to buy various goods to explain the prices of those things. I just need to know what's the stockpile of those goods at any moment, and then tell me the preference rankings of the consumers and then the producers in terms of the reservation demand, and I can explain the formation of those prices. Okay. So now, if I have those prices, I can start explaining the prices of the land and the natural resources and the capital good that went into making that final consumer good based on their contributions to it. Okay, and we'll get into that a lot more in the next course. Okay, but the point right now is to understand the relationship between prices. The Austrians think, you know, philosophically or logically, you start with the retail prices, and you know how those are determined through subjective preferences, and then you understand how much producers are willing to bid on the things that go into making those consumer goods because of those final prices, right? So if, so that moves up the chain like so. So this right here, this C, that stands for a capital good. So that's a means of production, a producer good that was produced by human beings. This N is a natural resource, so that's like iron ore or whatever, fertilizer or something, well, a mineral. And this L stands for labor. Okay, so labor, capital goods, and natural resources all combine to make this consumer good. So historically, technologically, in terms of the flow of time, obviously, time flows downward like this. So just to make sure you understand what's going on here in this diagram. So this consumer good right here that was, or sorry, capital good that was used to make this consumer good, this capital good itself, if it's a capital good, what does that mean? It was produced by human beings. So where did it come from? Oh, well, there was these other capital goods that were involved in its production, and this, you know, some input of labor and some input of a natural resource or more natural resources, okay, were all involved in the production of this particular capital good. And then then where did this capital good come from? Well, the same story. There was a prior capital good, and there was labor and natural resources and so on. But ultimately, if you went back through human history, you would reach a point at which no capital goods existed. You know, there were no tools or equipment. It was just a bunch of people, a bunch of savages grunting and scratching themselves. And so that was, you know, raw labor power. And they had a bunch of natural resources at their disposal. And then somebody had the bright idea to make the first capital good. Okay? So that's the idea. So historically, time flows downward like this. There was a point way back in human history when there were no capital goods, and they came together to create the first capital good, and then that capital good was used in combination with labor power and other natural resources to make a subsequent capital good, and so on, down through history. And then now, you know, everything is made with the help of capital goods, until finally get consumer goods, all right? So that's, you know, in terms of cause and effect, physically, that's, of course, time flows forward, and the producer goods are made before the finished consumer good, obviously. So somebody had to plant an apple tree before apples could be handed over to a consumer in the grocery store, you know, obviously. Apple trees produce the apples. But in order to explain the market price of an apple tree, or, you know, of an orchard that, or orchard that has a bunch of apple trees on it, to explain why is it if I wanted to buy this parcel of land that had all these trees on it that are shooting out apples, to understand that price, where does that come from? You have to know what is the price, what's the market price of apples. I have to be able to go to the grocery store and say, how much do consumers pay for apples? Ah, they pay this much per pound, so now I can reason backwards and say, given that apples cost this much per pound or have a price of this much per pound, and then I know technologically these trees are going to shoot out this many apples, the rate of interest is such and such, therefore I can explain why producers are willing to pay such and such for a given apple tree or for a whole plot of land that has a bunch of apple trees on it. Okay, so that's how this, that's where we're going with this but I just want you to understand the basics of this diagram. Okay. Rothbard then refines the formula to include the possibility of production. Okay, so just to be clear, the formula before was correct, but he was just lumping all expenditures into one category called monetary expenditures. So now he's disaggregating it to make it clearer that if the organization that this equation is applying to is a business and not just a consumer, that we can keep these things distinct. So with this refined equation, so again, the previous equation was true. I'm not saying the previous equation was wrong, but the previous equation lumped together things that now Rothbard's splitting out. So now we say money income equals consumption expenditures plus investment expenditures plus the net addition to the cash balance. Okay, so the distinction is now he's breaking up expenditures into those that are just, you know, so outflows of money that are used to acquire things that are for your direct satisfaction of your wants, that's consumption, whereas investment expenditures refer to those transactions when you're, you know, trading away your money, units of money, in order to acquire things, not that you don't directly value, they don't directly give you satisfaction, but they're going to be means to satisfaction in the future. Okay? So that's what that equation is doing. And Rothbard points out that a producer, generally speaking, will strive to maximize his net business income, but not necessarily his overall net income. And by the net there, I mean the difference of income and expenditure. So a producer, in his capacity as producer, other things equal, wants to increase his income, you know, his revenues from selling things to customers, and he wants to minimize his costs. He wants to minimize how much money he's spending on the things that he needs to produce for his business, because he wants that gap to be as large as possible. But then, is it overall, in terms of his, you know, not just being a producer but also a consumer, there's no reason necessarily that he wants to keep having his cash balance grow month after month. You know, he might, you know, if he can make his business yield more and more net income, meaning have income above his expenditures, then he might just take those and consume more. Okay, so he always wants to be able to consume more, but he might not want to add to his cash balances. Okay, that's the idea. In terms of his whole integrated household, in his role as both a producer and a consumer. But in his role just as a producer, he would like to expand his cash balances because that's the way he consumes. Okay, that if he earns net income on the business side of his life and builds up the cash balances that way, well, then he can turn around then as a consumer and draw down those cash balances by going out to the store and restaurants and so on. That's what Rothbard's getting at. Okay, some general tendencies. Other things equal, laborers will take positions offering the highest wages, investors will seek opportunities offering the highest rate of return, and buyers will seek out the cheapest price for a good. But again, it's crucial to keep in mind the caveat that other things have to be equal. Right? So if you're a worker and you have some job prospects, it's not necessarily true that you will always take the job that has the highest paycheck, because the work, you know, could be really stressful. Maybe there's certain people at that office you can't stand. Maybe you have moral misgivings about that type of industry. Or maybe, you know, you don't have any problem with any of that stuff, but maybe you just really love writing poetry and you would rather, you know, earn $30,000 a year writing poetry rather than earning $150,000 a year being a corporate lawyer. It's not that you got anything against being a corporate lawyer, it's just you love poetry. You think that's more important, and you would just be happier doing that. So that's fine. There's nothing uneconomical about somebody turning down a well-paying job and taking a job that doesn't pay much for, you know, non-pecuniary reasons. But it is important to understand things that other things equal, people will tend to sell their labor for the highest price, which is the same way of saying they will take jobs that pay the most in salary or wages. Same thing with investors. Other things equal, they're going to want to put their money where the rate of return is the highest, but their other things may not be equal. So, you know, I know a lot of people that are libertarian and they won't invest in companies that are directly tied to the government. Like, they wouldn't want to invest in Halliburton or Lockheed or things like that because they feel that money's tainted. All right. So, you know, that's just one example. Or, like, if you're a space enthusiast and you got a bunch of money, maybe you'll invest in some company that's trying to develop new ways of, you know, putting people into orbit, even though in terms of your business acumen, you know, this is a long shot and this, you know, they're probably going to lose my money or whatever, but you might do it because it's you know, in the sense you think you're contributing to the cause or something, and you feel better about doing that rather than putting your money in tobacco companies or something. All right, so that's, again, there's nothing uneconomical about that. It's not that economics says, oh, you made a wrong decision. You're supposed to try to go out and make as much money as you can. That economics does not say that at all. Because, in fact, the well-trained economist understands the folly of that almost better than anybody else. Because the average person is used to thinking, oh, when I get more money, I'm happier. But the economist understands, no, the whole reason you want to get money is so that you can spend it. It would be pointless for you to accumulate money if you never spent it. Then what's the point of having the money? Okay, so it would be nonsensical for someone every year of his life to just keep building up his cash balances and then just die with a bunch of money like Scrooge McDuck. That I mean, if a person wants to do it, you know, I can't object to it, but the point is certainly economics doesn't say that's what you ought to be doing. No, economics just says money is a medium of exchange, and if you want, what you can do is you can sell things in the present, accumulate money, and then if you want, you can trade the money away for other goods and services down the road. And there's no, you know, you don't get zapped for drawing down your cash balances. Okay, Rothbard has a little discussion on non-exchangeable goods, and I put that in quotation marks because some of the things he's talking about were actually exchangeable goods. It's just they might not have had a high market value, all right? So it's whereas some of the stuff were clearly non-exchangeable, but my point is just if you got a little bit stumped by this section because it seemed like some of the things were exchangeable and Rothbard was calling them non-exchangeable. Really what he means is there are certain things that even though the goods can be transferable, there are certain properties that go with them or certain features that might not transfer with the exchange of the tangible good. All right, so anyway, whatever you want to call it, let me just make sure you understand the principle. So with this forest, what I have in mind is, let's say you own a 1,000-year-old old-growth forest. Right? I don't know for people in other countries this is a big deal, but in the United States, there's this big thing that it's not only that environmentalists want to keep forests in general from being cut down, but there's certain forests that are called old growth, meaning like there's trees there that are hundreds of years old, or maybe even some are 1,000 years old. And so the idea is a lot of environmentalists would be horrified if, even if we cut down those trees but then replanted them, they would say, no, that's not good enough. That you would have permanently destroyed this natural treasure if you were to cut down these trees because they're hundreds of years old and we can never reproduce that. Okay, so that's the idea. So my point here is, or what Rothbard is going to say, a lot of people criticize capitalism. And they're going to say, look, in this in this system, this capitalist system, it's perverse because it leads you to only to direct your activities towards those things that can make money. And so when it comes, so yeah, if you are a musician and you're very talented, then maybe that'll work. And you can go out and you can perform concerts and charge people ticket revenue and so forth, and you can make a living that way, fine. But for some things that are important, and we can all agree are culturally very important and useful and so forth, it's the link, the ability to be able to make money off that sometimes is lacking. And so the capitalist mentality leads us to think, therefore, it's not important. But really, of course, it's very important. So here, for example, you know, these old growth forests, just because you can't get rich off of having them exist doesn't mean, the argument would go, that they're not important and that you should just bulldoze them down and put up a parking lot in a mall because you can make more money from it that way. You know, the narrow economist view would say, oh, this land is obviously more productive if we take all these old trees and get them out of here and put in a parking lot in a mall, because then people will spend money and we can charge, you know, the rental rate of the land will go up, whereas now it's just sitting there uselessly. These old trees aren't making us any money. So that's that mentality a lot of people don't like. But Rothbard makes the point that even though it is true, there are some things like that, that we can agree that they're valuable and so forth, but yet it's they don't really have a market just because of the nature of the thing. He's saying even so, capitalism actually makes it more likely that we're going to save those things. As Rothbard says, look, it's the trade-off between having more food or more clothing or something or having a roof over your head versus something that's sort of aesthetic, like a bunch of old trees that are sitting there, that they're not really, you know, performing services for us in the same way that having a steak does. Okay, that, you know, they're providing a service, you know, just our knowledge that they exist, and if we want to walk through it and enjoy the view and so forth, I mean, that, in a sense, gives us satisfaction, but there's also a sense in which, you know, that's more of a higher order thing. And so Rothbard's point is, capitalism, by making us wealthier, by vastly increasing the output of steaks and clothes and houses and so forth, makes us, you know, gives us the luxury of not chopping down this old growth forest. And so it's, Rothbard says, the critics have it exactly backward. It's precisely because capitalism increases the production of the exchangeable goods that then their marginal utility goes way down because we have so much more of them. And so on the margin, if the choice is between cutting down this old growth forest and putting up one more shopping mall, we might not put up a shopping mall because we've got so many other shopping malls that on the margin, putting up one more is not a big deal. And so we can afford to not have the trees. But if we got rid of the capitalist system, then we'd be on the brink of starvation. And so then if the choice comes down to cutting down these trees, if that provides us with the means of, you know, some more material comforts, we'd be more likely to do it because we're so poor. We don't care about, you know, we don't have the luxury of keeping these trees undeveloped. That's the idea. And the same thing, what I'm doing here with this T-ball thing is to say another example maybe of a non-exchangeable good would be spending time with your family. And so a lot of critics would say, oh, you know, capitalism forces you to go out and you're always worried about making money to make ends meet and so forth. And so people are too worried about their job and they come home, they work 8 hour weeks and they're exhausted and they can't go and watch their kid's T-ball game. And so if we could just get away from capitalism, people wouldn't be worried about money so much and they could focus on the more important things like your family. And so in that sort of context, Rothbard would make the same point and say, no, it's the other way around. Because capitalism vastly increases the productivity of labor, we are fantastically wealthy, and so we have the luxury, first of all, of not making our kids work in the field or in the coal mines or in factories, that they can go play games, and that our work weeks are a lot shorter because our labor is so much more productive. And so we have the luxury of going and watching kids play baseball. You know, the peasants in the Middle Ages, it wasn't true that their kids just lounged around, did nothing all day, or played games, and the parents would work 8 hours and then come home and watch their kids play. That's crazy. No, those people had much harder lives than we do now, and they had much less leisure time because they weren't as developed and their social systems were not as capitalistic. So that's what Rothbard would say in response to that sort of objection to capitalism. Okay, what do people do? And here Rothbard is kind of rounding out the discussion. He's saying, for everybody, whatever stocks of goods or services they own, they allocate them by marginal utility. So here, this picture on the left, I'm trying to show here that workers, they own a bunch of labor services, or if you want to think of it in terms of hours of their time that they allocate. And so in principle, what happens is a worker continues to sell labor so long as the wage rate he's receiving for like another hour of labor is worth more to him than the next best use of his control of his body, which would be leisure. All right, so let me say that again. So a worker will keep selling more and more units of labor so long as, on the margin, selling one more unit, the wages he receives for it, he values subjectively the wages, meaning what he could acquire with that money, he values that more than the leisure he could have had if he didn't sell that extra hour of labor. Okay, so just like, you know, when we remember we're trying to explain, someone goes into a grocery store and he sees that cans of tuna fish are on sale for, you know, $1 a piece, let's say. They're really big cans of tuna fish. And he has $10 in the beginning, and then he buys four of them. How do we explain that in terms of marginal utility? We say, oh, well, the first can of tuna fish, the marginal utility of that was higher than the marginal utility of the $10 bill. So that's why he bought the first one. The second one, second can of tuna fish, had less marginal utility than the first can, right, because there's diminishing marginal utility. But that still had more marginal utility than the ninth dollar bill. And then the third can of tuna fish had more than the eighth dollar bill. And the fourth can of tuna fish had more than the seventh dollar bill. But when he was considering buying that fifth can of tuna fish, nope, on the margin, the marginal utility of, what, the sixth dollar bill was higher than of that fifth can of tuna fish. Okay, and the reason that's going to happen at some point is that as he gets more and more cans of tuna fish, their marginal utility is going down, whereas as he has fewer and fewer dollar bills, because he's trading away more and more of them for tuna, their marginal utility goes up, because his supply of dollar bills is shrinking. All right, so if you get it there, in that context, it's the same thing with labor. In principle, somebody can, you know, is going to keep offering more and more units of labor in exchange for a given wage rate so long as the utility to that person of getting that extra money for one more, you know, hourly payment is higher than the leisure that he's sacrificing. But at some point he stops. A person doesn't work literally 24 hours a day because at some point on the margin, no. As I'm getting more and more money, the margin utility of it goes down, and as I have less and less leisure, the margin utility of my leisure is going up and up. And so, you know, after I've worked 15 hours in a given day to work a 16th hour in exchange for whatever, $20 an hour, that trade-off on the margin is different from the beginning when I had only worked 2 hours. Now I'm thinking, do I want to work a third hour for $20 when I only got 40 so far for that day? That's the idea. Now, in practice, of course, depending on the job, you might not be able to literally determine how many hours you get to work per day. All right, so that's a complication. But by the same token, if you're out buying Cheerios, you don't get to decide how many of the little O's that you're going to buy. you know, you have to buy it in terms of the packaging and the size that the manufacturer produces. You can only buy a box at a time. You can't buy 6.24 boxes. Okay, but that's sort of a technical thing in terms of the packaging. So something like that happens in the labor markets too. You might not be able to say, today I want to work 3 hours and tomorrow I want to work 8 hours. That's why, incidentally, I picked migrant farm workers, because I think with those labor markets being more informal and in certain settings, I think it's possible that someone can just show up and just pick a certain amount and get paid based on how much they pick, or they're obviously not signing year-long contracts saying I'm going to come in and work this many hours per week and I have this much health care and so forth. Something as simple as on the right-hand side here, water. I just want to show you here. If you have a stockpile of water, you allocate it to different uses based on marginal utility. So if you only had a few gallons, you would probably reserve it for drinking because that would be the most important use to you. You get a few more gallons after that, you devote some of them to taking a shower. You get more gallons, maybe you water your lawn. You get more gallons, you wash your car. Okay, that's the idea, so that you allocate things according to how much you have and then the marginal utilities of those different possible uses. Okay, and then the last slide for today, where do the goods come from? So no, they don't come from Santa Claus. What I want to set up here is that Rothbard is preparing us to see, as we move into the next sections, that thus far we've been explaining prices of goods that are just, they're just there, right? We're looking at a snapshot in time with Smith and Johnson. We were saying, for some reason, that guy Smith happened to have 90 barrels of fish and Johnson happened to have one horse. And then, given that they have these certain preference rankings, what would be the range of equilibrium prices? And then we went ahead and we figured that out. All right, so that analysis was correct as far as it went, but it raises the obvious question, well, why is it that Smith happened to have 90 barrels of fish and Johnson had one horse? Why were those things in their possession at that time? And then you see that in a modern market economy, a lot of the goods that are in physical existence at any moment in time were deliberately produced in order to be sold. All right, so what may have happened in that horse and fish example is maybe Johnson, I think I'm getting the names right, I think it was Johnson with the horse, maybe his job is a horse breeder. And so, maybe for years he had been planning on selling a horse for 85 barrels of fish or more. And he was in that business because he thought that, oh yeah, that's a lucrative thing, that how much would it cost me to raise a horse and so forth. Okay, so, and incidentally here, this is an interesting point because I've been arguing with people on my blog about the cost theory of value versus the subjective value theory. So it's a crucial thing here. We're not done with the economic analysis just because we explained how you would find the price between fish and horses given those realities. Like, there's a lot more we can say as economists about the market and about production and pricing and all the what was true of the cost theory of value. We can take those insights and incorporate them into a better framework, because we've seen by itself the cost theory of value wasn't really a good framework because it led to all sorts of contradictions and problems and it didn't really explain market prices from scratch. But by the same token, there's a lot of stuff going on with the cost theory of value, the relationships they saw, that we don't yet have the ability to fully spell out with our Austrian approach, but that is because we haven't covered production theory. Okay, so what Rothbard is saying is, thus far, we really just talked about, given that there's a stockpile of goods, how are prices formed, and what do people do with their goods. So like in the last slide, I was talking about, you know, if you have a stockpile of water, how do you allocate it? Oh, the first gallons you allocate to drinking, and then the, you know, the next bundle you allocate to showering and so forth. But why would you have 100 gallons versus having 3 or versus 10,000? Where's that water coming from? And so that's coming under the, you know, heading of production theory. And that's the heart of what we're going to do in the next section of the book, chapters 5 through 9. That's mostly production theory, and we'll have a much better understanding of that. But for right now, Rofford's just giving you a little taste, saying, you know, it's going to have to do with the fact that producers think they're going to make money, right? That they think they can spend a certain amount on inputs, on hiring labor, capital goods, and natural resources, using them technologically to make products or services, and then selling those for revenue to their customers. And they think that they're going to be able to add to their cash balances over, you know, a certain period of time doing that. And that's why they do it. So physically, where are the goods coming from? It's because there's producers who are doing that kind of stuff. That's why we have horses, and that's why we have gallons of water that are being delivered, and we have cans of tuna fish. Okay, but there what's going on is the producers are making guesses, expectations about what those prices are going to be in the future that they're going to be able to charge to their customers. So we already know, we've already covered the material in Man, Economy, and State to be able to say, given that those production decisions were made in the past, they were what they were, now, boom, we've got one horse sitting here that Johnson has, you know, spent years breeding and so forth, and now he's got this horse that he's raised from its birth, and it's ready to go. And this other guy here, he's a fisherman, and he's been out, you know, building nets and practicing and figuring out where the best spot to drop his nets are. And he has a boat and everything, and he spent money keeping his boat in good repair. And right now, boom, he's got 90 barrels of fish. How do we explain the prices? Well, now we already know that. Okay, so it's, we don't need to know the background story to be able to explain the prices that are being formed right now in the spot market. But the point is, there is this complex interrelationship, interdependency of people in the past were looking ahead, guessing as to what those prices would be, guessing as to, well, gee, how many barrels of fish will I be able to get if I, you know, raise this horse and feed him well and keep him in good health and then bring him to market in 3 years, how many barrels of fish do I think I can get? And then because Johnson had those expectations, he did it. Now he's in the position of actually having that horse. And the same thing with Smith. He thought ahead and said, you know, I bet you if I were able to deliver 85 barrels of fish, I could get a horse for it, and that would be worth it to me at that time. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. I'm going to keep my nets in good repair. I'm going to go buy the gasoline to put in my outboard motor, and I'm going to go get my fish. Okay, so that's, you know, that's a big picture of what's going on here, and we're going to understand that a lot more if you stick around and we go through the next, you know, the heart of the book in the next course. Okay, well, we got about 12 minutes left, so let me check your questions for this week. Just log in here. Okay, this is week 6. Okay, Lewis says, and incidentally, this is the only question that's been posted here, so you guys who are logged in right now, if you have questions, you can go ahead and post them in the chat box because I'll probably be able to hit a few of them. Lewis says, Dr. Murphy, when you ask in a study guide on page 52 about the application of Mises' regression theorem to fiat money, does this imply going further back in time to the day before paper was first introduced as a claim on specific amounts of the commodities already used as a generally accepted medium of exchange, essentially gold? Let me grab my study guide to make sure I know what you're talking about. So just remember, everybody, if you're working your way through Man, Economy, and State, this study guide is obviously, I wrote it to help you. So you should be using it, that I think it's a good summary, and then some of the questions may provoke you and make you connect the dots more. So what Lewis is asking is, I guess there wasn't too much more of the question. Question number 8 was, how does Mises' money regression apply to fiat money? So let me just tell you what I had in mind there. I think what you said, Lewis, is right, but I'll just say it in my own words. So the reason I asked the question is, of course, Mises' regression theorem, and this will come up later as well, but the regression theorem, I don't remember, I don't think we've actually used that term in my lectures for this class, because I know it's coming later in the book, and I was going to save the discussion for then, but obviously I'm alluding to it already in the study guide. What the regression theorem says is that, think back to Menger's theory of the origin of money. Okay, so I walked you through that pretty carefully, I think, last lecture. So Menger is saying money did not come from the state, that originally money must have been a commodity in the market like other commodities. You know, if we think back to when there was just direct exchange, and then people realized the limitations of direct exchange, and so they started initially accepting certain goods, not because they wanted to directly consume them or use them in production, but because they were just going to trade them away in the future. And so those goods were media of exchange. They weren't yet money. They were media of exchange. And then because certain goods were more marketable and people started accepting them because of their marketability, that in and of itself enhanced their marketability, giving them more of an advantage. And so that process started snowballing, and then certain goods, because of various characteristics like their durability, their divisibility, the fact that they were homogeneous and that they were easily recognizable by people, the fact that they had convenient market values relative to, you know, their weight and the ease of transporting them. Because of those properties, certain goods were more likely to be accepted as media of exchange than other ones, and eventually one or more of them became commonly accepted, and that's what money is. It's a commonly accepted medium of exchange. Okay, so if that's the story we're telling, and what Mises' regression theorem says, and again, we'll talk about this more carefully later on, but what Mises' regression theorem says is the money on any given day in the present, you explain its purchasing power ultimately by going backwards in time. The reason money has purchasing power today is that people knew that it had purchasing power yesterday, so they think it's going to have purchasing power tomorrow, and that's how you explain things. Okay, again, I'm simplifying it because I'm going to cover it more carefully later on in the book. All right, so, and then Mises says, and ultimately it goes back to when the thing was used as a commodity in the marketplace. So that's all well and good if you're looking at a society that's using gold, because you can say, oh, yeah, I can imagine back during the days of barter that people still liked gold because it was shiny and pretty, or maybe they used it for industrial purposes or what have you. But when it comes to fiat money, that's a little bit weird. It's because how do you tie fiat money back to the primitive days of barter? Like, what's the connection there? How can it be, you know, isn't it true, in other words, to say that fiat money must have been created by the state and that did not emerge out of the marketplace and was not a commodity that was originally valued for its own sake? Okay, so there, the way Mises handles that is he says that no, fiat, I mean, in one sense, yeah, fiat money is created by the state, obviously, but it's not that it was created out of the clear blue sky and the people weren't using money and then all of a sudden are now using fiat money. That's not how it happened historically. He said the way it happens historically is fiat monies originally were not fiat. They were originally claims on the market money that was a commodity. And then when the government got people habituated to handling its paper notes in daily commerce and keeping them in their wallets and purses, at some point then the government suspended redeemability and then eventually just said, no, we're never going to redeem it. And so that, and then people, it just stuck. Okay, so for example, the U.S. dollar used to be tied to gold and earlier to silver. All right, so if you had a federal, well, at one point they weren't even Federal Reserve, but you get a treasury note, I mean, those, you could turn it in somewhere and get actual gold or silver. And so that's why people carried them around, is because they were just claims on the real money. And then famously in 1933, FDR said, nope, we're not doing that anymore. Those green pieces of paper that you guys have, you don't get to turn them in for anything. Okay, so that's how we got to the point in the United States now where dollar bills circulate as money, even though they're not clearly not, you know, commodities in the marketplace, and they never were, but they used to be claims on things that came out of the marketplace. Okay, we've got time for one more question. I'm not sure if this is directed at me or others, but Jock Coates says, what worries me about labor history is that it appears that over time, for a given appreciation of leisure, people work longer now than ever. Hunter-gatherers could provide necessities on an average of 3 hours a day and then sit around and sing songs to each other. Now, in the UK at least, it takes an average of 16 hours a day for someone to start buying a house, even let alone leisure. At some point, leisure becomes valueless since there's no time to enjoy it. And sorry, I think probably now that I'm looking at this, Jock was having a discussion with people and that wasn't directed at me, but we got 2 minutes. Let me just comment on that. I mean, for one thing, just look at what you're saying. You're saying hunter-gatherers could work 3 hours and get the necessities and then sing songs to each other, and now in the UK, you got to work 16 hours a day to start buying a house. Okay, the hunter-gatherers weren't living in a house, right? And I don't think it's correct to say, oh, yeah, but that's because, you know, their environment was so much different that it was, you know, their daily life was just as pleasant living outdoors as it is in the UK living in a house. Okay, so, I mean, it may be that people living in the Serengeti or something could live outdoors, and you would, but if they were living in England right now, working 3 hours a day back then, they would probably die. Okay, so I'm just saying, you know, be careful. It's true, people do work. It's possible that people work more hours now than in certain periods of history, and I'm not familiar enough with the literature to know, to be able to say authoritatively, oh, in this time period, this is how hard people work. But my point is, our material standard of living now is infinitely higher than it was back then. I mean, just indoor plumbing, for example. I mean, we live in certain respects. We poor people in the United States right now have a fantastically higher standard of living than Louis XIV did. I mean, just if you showed him an iPhone, he would think you were a sorcerer. Okay, and so, it, you know, and a critic could say, okay, come on, give me a break. these are all sort of manufactured wants. You don't really need an iPhone. You don't need to be able to play Angry Birds while you're going to the bathroom. You know, that's not, if we didn't have iPhones, you wouldn't even know that you were missing that. You know, and that's fine. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But my point is, human labor right now is incredibly more productive than it was when people were hunter-gatherers. And so for any sort of, I think, if you really try to make it literally an apples-to-apples comparison, no pun intended, human labor right now can produce the same amount of calories and sustenance as hunter-gatherers did back then in a fraction of the time it took them to do it. Okay, it's a lot easier to feed one person today than it was to feed one person back then. The reason we feel poorer now is because we're trying to keep up with the Joneses. We don't literally just work enough so that we don't die. We work enough so that we don't have to wear tattered clothes, and that we can keep, you know, have a car that's not too old, and that we can, you know, go on vacation once a year and so forth, and get a college degree, and all, you know what I mean? So there's a lot more stuff that people are spending money on now than they were back then. And you can say, well, that's just because they've been brainwashed by commercialism. And again, probably a lot of that's true. But my point is still that I think we need to be careful and say that it's not so much that labor is less productive now and that therefore we have less leisure. It's that people feel that they need to spend their money on a lot of stuff that was not considered essential 1,000 years ago or whenever, you know, several thousand years ago. Okay, we're over time there, and we'll stop, and thank you everyone for tuning in. I'll have your quiz posted by Friday morning, so just make sure you take that if you're taking the class for credit, and I'll see you guys either in the office hours on Saturday or next week.